This is Hal Helms. I'm here with Jeff Peters, and we're going to be talking about Fusebox and the flip process. And I think, Jeff, that one of the hardest things for new Fuseboxers to do is to put all the pieces together. You know, you've got Fusebox, and now with Fusebox 4.1, you've got even more stuff to learn. And then you've got flip, and you've got wireframes, and dev notes, and prototypes, and Fuse docs, and for somebody who's an old hand at it, well, they've been learning this all along. But for somebody who's new to the process, it can be pretty intimidating.
That's really true. There's an awful lot of stuff out there, and I think I know I tend to take a lot of it for granted, really, when we're looking around. Well, so and so should know whatever it is, fill in the subject already. And it's kind of a trap that we tend to fall into. It seems like when we do conferences and things, we're always looking for, well, what haven't I spoken on before? Mm-hmm. And I think we maybe tend to overlook that there's a lot of people out there that are in the same place that a lot of people were 2 or 3 years ago. And while Fusebox has grown up a little bit, we still have the whole spectrum of users that are available to be talked to.
Yep. So I thought one thing that would be helpful is to go through the process from beginning to end.
The flip process?
Yep, Fusebox and flip.
Mm-hmm.
I do more consulting and teaching on it, so I think it'll give us a good balance. When I first start off on a project, typically I'll be brought in as a consultant. And the number one problem that people have, and it gets reflected in that 70% failure rate that I always talk about, is that we have these sort of, you know, two worlds. John Edwards talks about two Americas. Well, there's two worlds. And the two worlds are the world of the techie and the world of the marketing, the suits.
Right, okay. Well, I want it noted for the record that you are the first one to bring politics into the discussion, so I'll try not to go down that rabbit trail. But I think you're right.
You should just carry on.
Oh, Hal, come on. You're tempting me to talk about the kids and the grown-ups, but, you know.
Well, that would be Bush League.
Well, yeah. Oh, getting on with the subject at hand. No, I think you're really right. The mindsets are completely different. And I think one of the things that has been an advantage to me is having had some of my formal training focused on systems analysis, and at that time in history, the concept of a systems analyst was the person who was the linguistic translator, if you will, between the coders, the programmers, and the business people, the suits. And back then, it was more formalized in terms of all three of those roles would be working within, for example, the IRM department or ADP department, as we used to call them. And so the analyst would be the person who would talk to the suits and the business process people and find out what they really wanted and then translate that into techie, so that the programmers could actually develop the program to do what the suits wanted. When we progressed into easier and easier technologies, and Cold Fusion is one of the easiest, lowest threshold technologies available, that role of systems analyst almost completely vanished, because so many people moved from the suit world or the business world into programming at the drop of a hat. They got a project thrown at them and said, well, we've read at the time Allaire's Press that says it's so easy to do something in Cold Fusion. Here, you do this thing and use Cold Fusion to figure out how to do it. And so now you have a business-oriented person who's suddenly a techie, a programmer. And there's no analyst in there to help either path. And then from the other end of the spectrum, we have programmers who, as Cold Fusion's reputation grew, began to look at it seriously and said, oh, this is really great. I can do things really quickly in it, and I'm a programmer and I know how to do programming things. And they didn't feel a need to talk to the business side of things. And I think that is a chronic failure in us as programmers, that we feel as though everyone should see the world the way we do.
Yeah, and we see the world very differently. You know, the two sides.
Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe worse than that. Maybe Venusians and Martians. And the problem that I see is, and that's interesting about the whole systems analyst thing, because not having that role, what happens is that we think we're talking, and we're not. We're using words, but they mean entirely different things to each of us.
Absolutely.
And sometimes the words simply aren't understood, and the other side doesn't stop and say, well, let's define our terms. And mm-hmm. so we get into a situation where, you know, meetings are endemic, and we go to meetings, and you spend 2 hours in a meeting, and you know, they're boring, and they're tiresome, and so you scribble down notes, and then oftentimes there may be a follow-up meeting or two, a couple of emails flying back and forth, but then the developers just sort of go off into their cave, and they start developing. And they come out 3 weeks, 3 months, you know, 13 months later with their interpretation of what the business folks wanted.
That makes perfect sense to the developers.
Absolutely.
Works fine.
And the business people, I often say that we involve business people and the clients really at two points in the process. At the beginning of the process, when it's too early for them to really give us any feedback, and then at the end of the process when it's too late for us to do anything about that feedback. But that really is when we get the feedback. And I always say, you know, the most dangerous words in the English language to a developer are, you know what would be nice? That's what we hear, and that's when we... This is... Everybody knows this, and yet the methodologies that we keep coming up with don't address that issue. You know, we're going to talk a little bit later about extreme programming, and its attempt to solve that problem. But it solves it for the techies and not for the business mm-hmm. people. But no one has... we seem to have squared off in our camps. And the developers say, if the business people would only tell us what they want, we would build it. And the business people, I don't know what they say, but they are not happy with the process.
Yeah, and it's really kind of surprising to me in that there have been really good tools available for prototyping and modeling. Demos. I mean, from the DOS days. Remember,
sure.
Dan Bricklin's
Absolutely.
Demo was a package that was available that would allow you to model behavior very similarly to what we do in the flip process, and nobody really seemed to incorporate it into a development process. It was it was kind of received as, well, that's nice, but it was a training tool, is mm-hmm. the way people saw it. And maybe that was because of the name. You know, he chose to call it demo.
Mm-hmm.
And people saw demo meant, well, that's something you put together for a trade show to try to sell the finished product.
Right.
And we didn't quite catch the flick that, well, wait a minute, maybe demo means demonstrate an idea before we've ever built anything.
I think developers tend to think if it's not code, it's not real, it's not valuable.
If it's not in the matrix, what is it?
Well, that's not the case anymore with HTML stuff, where the demo, the prototype, really can become the, you know, the working code.
Mm-hmm.
And I've stopped calling it a prototype because it gets negative reactions.
Mm-hmm.
So I just call it a front end first.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do the front end first. That's something that business people seem to understand when I tell them, well, we have to do the front end anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I was at a very large corporation, and they brought me in for training and for consulting, and I preached the gospel of flip, and they got the religion. And I went away for 6 months, and for 6 months they developed the prototype, they worked with the clients, you know, they would send me emails occasionally, and I was sort of monitoring the process, and then they brought me back in to architect the application. So the first thing I asked them was, Are you confident that you've included the clients and that you've gotten the feedback? Yes, they were very confident. I said, well, humor me and set up a meeting with your clients. They had, this is all done internally, and they had four people who were their clients. So we had a chat with these folks, and the first thing that the developers did was they sat down at the computer and started running through the demo. And I said, well, wait, let's put the client in there and let the client click through it. Within 3 minutes, it was obvious that the prototype, which they had worked on for 6 months and the client had seen numerous times, would not work.
Just because it wouldn't do what the client wanted it to do?
Once the client sat down and clicked this, they said, oh, well, wait a minute. You know, for this, you know, I'm looking at this package, but I need to see the entire shipment that it came from. And the developers were stunned. It's the first time they'd heard it. But it was because they had guided the clients through the process in a way that made the clients passive. Sit the client down and let them, and ask them to run, you know, through use cases. That's the, you know, the term for little pieces of functionality that clients wanted to be able to do. So like in an e-commerce app, we'd say like, all right, I want to add a product to a shopping cart, and watch the client do it. And that's when you're going to get the kind of feedback. So it turned out that that week I was there, we spent really doing the front end first.
So you took them through the flip process then?
And they already knew all about the flip process. They just
got derailed?
They thought they were doing it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was very interesting because, I mean, there was no resistance they had to it. They really thought they were doing it. But it shows the degree to which our own prejudices and biases and just our own, the way we view the world seeps into everything we do. So they said, okay, got it. We got the message that we have to do a prototype, but it still was they were driving the process and the clients were passive. When you actually put the client down there and say, do this, that's when you find out what clients need to do.
Cool. So can we use them as an example and kind of go through the flip process, and we can talk about maybe what they should have done versus what they did do.
Excellent.
And we can okay, well, let's just take a few minutes. We'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll start at the beginning of the flip process, and you can tell me about some of that stuff, and we'll go from there.